The podcast. Hi, everyone. Welcome to the most recent episode of Reappropriate the Podcast. I want to welcome all of you viewers to a special episode recording of our podcast regarding the events in Ferguson. Tonight, I have with me my guest, Snoopy Jenkins, who blogs at snoopyjenkins.wordpress.com and can be found at Twitter at @SnoopyJenkins. Snoopy Jenkins, or James, do you want to say hi?
What's going on? How y'all doing?
Hi. So I want to thank everybody for listening to this podcast. Tonight we are going to be talking about all of the issues surrounding Ferguson and the national protests happening in Ferguson, Missouri, as well as around the country. I want to really quickly let you know that in our podcast we do invite user participation, so you can participate in the conversation in a couple of different ways. First, you can tweet me at @reappropriate, and also if you are live streaming the podcast, you can participate by submitting questions through the question and answer app, which should be on the right hand side of your screen, and we will endeavor to read all of the questions and comments that we get on the show and hopefully get you guys engaged in the conversation. So without further ado, I want to talk a little bit today about the Mike Brown shooting that happened last Saturday, and specifically all of the conversation around race that's been happening since the shooting on Saturday. And I invited James on because he has some very strong opinions about what's going on. So I just want to get the conversation off asking what I think is possibly a bit of a silly question, which is, James, the Mike Brown shooting, which happened on Saturday, was a shooting by a Ferguson police officer of an unarmed teenager as he was being stopped walking down the street. And I think that I'm going to ask you an obvious question. Do you think the shooting was racial? Yeah, I'm sorry. It's an icebreaker question.
Well, what a way to break the ice. First of all, I wanted to make sure I said thank you, Jen, for having me on Reappropriate the Podcast again. I don't think I had a chance to thank you in person on the podcast before. That being said, yes. No,
yes.
Look, yes. Yes, the shooting was racial, okay?
Okay.
The response to the shooting has been racial. Everything we know about the shooting thus far involves a direct and really personal, for many black men out there, interaction with race, i.e. the perception of criminality involving black men just by, you know, existing in public. And everything that we know about the shooting involves the destruction of the black body, a particular black body, by virtue of other people's perceptions of criminality and violence and threat level and all the things that go along with being black and male in America. And I know I'm stepping on some toes by saying black and male. I just don't think this happens to other people in the same way. We all go through racial interactions. We all deal with race. We do not all deal with race in the exact same fashion at the exact same time. And I think that's true within racial groups and also true out, you know, with various racial groups. Intra and interracially, we deal with race differently. I think one thing that this particular event has made clear for many people who have ignored it with stories of like Eric Garner's death in New York City or Oscar Grant's death in Oakland, I'm getting that right, or various other examples of this, Trayvon Martin and
Ezell Ford. You said Eric Garner, Malik Jones, I believe his name was, in East Haven.
Jordan Davis, Sean Bell, like, I mean, it.
Oscar Grant.
Have a list. I mean, this alone is the most bizarre element of this. There is right now a long and storied list of African American men who die at the hands of police or interactions with police that we know about. The ones that make national and international news. The fact that that exists for black men and yet does not exist for Asian American men, Latino men, white men, black women. I mean, I made a really crass joke about this the other day, but let's be very, very clear on this. As disheartening as it might be for many of us to deal with, and I think this is something that we all need to care about as citizens in America, the cops aren't shooting at everyone.
Right. And I think that what's really surprising to me when I ask this question is that there could possibly be another answer, that there are people out there who would argue that this shooting isn't racial. I mean, one of the statistics that is floating around right now as we talk about Ferguson online is that every 28 hours a black man is shot and killed by police. That's every 28 hours. It's every day, police brutality. And it's hard to imagine that a statistic like this, if we were talking about any other group besides black men, would not garner complete outrage and protests and riots in the streets. But it takes what seem to be flash-in-the-pan moments for the nation to wake up and say, this is not okay, when this seems to be the reality for black men. And getting to your other point, I think that it is important to point out that this is something that black men face to a much larger degree than other people do, and that that's okay in the sense that everybody's relationship to the race and racism that they face can be different, and we can have conversations about race and racism where we acknowledge that what some people are facing isn't similar to what other people are facing and still find ways to be in solidarity with them. And so for me, what really strikes me is that this is a chance to talk about the race and racism issues that black men uniquely face, which is this idea of black male threat, the myth of black male threat and criminality. So one of the things that we were talking about in the car, which sort of sparked this kind of this conversation, that my idea to podcast this, was that I'm surprised that with the Ferguson shooting, people are finding out for the first time about the idea of the talk, with capital letters, the talk, as if you responded that most people who are not black men do not have the talk with their parents. So do you want to elaborate a little bit on what the talk is?
Okay, well, you can find this out just by typing into Google the talk, black male or black male families or black men, etc. The talk. There's this conversation that happens in a lot of African-American households where fathers speak with sons, mothers speak with sons about what to do in case you were stopped by the police. Because by virtue of being a black male in this society, living where black males live, rural environments as well as urban ones, especially urban ones, there's a very high likelihood that in a lot of these spaces, as a young black male, and I mean anywhere from like 5 up, you're going to be stopped by police, interact with police in a hostile situation where you will presume to be engaged in criminal activity more often than not. My parents discussed what to do when stopped by the police with me, and they kept discussing it and kept discussing it. And I mean not just like, James, here's what you do when stopped by the police. No, I mean like every time I would go out with my friends, every time I would leave the house, every time there was any possibility that I could be out in a public space anywhere doing anything, voluntarily, my parents would bring it up upon themselves to discuss, okay, you know, what do we do when we're stopped by the police, James? What do we do? How are we courteous? How do we remember the rights and privileges that we do have without trying to engender the kind of negativity that can happen when police stop you? And I want to bring up a couple of different texts here. The best way to sort of understand the fear in black households when it comes to police interaction would probably be to read a couple different books. One of them, the landmark New Jim Crow by Michelle Alexander, the law professor. While I don't agree with the political project of the book, and I'm more on that in a second, it would be absolutely crucial to know the knowledge that's in that book for everyone, not just black families, not just black men, but everyone. If you want to understand not just the mass incarceration state, the ways in which the criminal justice system harms black men, but also the ways that racial disparities in how we treat black people, black men especially, because of the perceived criminality in that demographic, how that perceived criminality can alter all of the interactions with police. My white friends, my Asian friends, they don't necessarily have the kinds of presumptions about hostile policing that I grew up with and that I still have today. And a lot of that has to do with the unequal treatment and the disparate treatment African-American males face in particular when dealing with police. And also the best way to sort of understand the historical and current trends when it comes to the myth of black criminality and why that's an important thing for all of us to know about would be to read Khalil Gibran Muhammad's The Criminalization of Black Men. In fact, I have that text over here somewhere. You want to know about where this came from, how statistics were manipulated from the earliest part, post Civil War, post Reconstruction, to create the only polarity outside of white criminality to be African American criminality, and where the roots of our understanding of these ideas come directly from historic trends and this idea that if a black person is doing anything, that person must be criminal as a offshoot or a photo negative of how we look at white criminals. So, for example, you have during migrations from Southern and Eastern Europe, those groups before they became essentially white in our society were seen as criminal and bestial in much the same way that we think of African American men today. But once those people started becoming folded into what the nation thought of as white, the foreign-born category when it came to criminal statistics was erased, and it just became white and Negro. So the otherizing element from white was Negro. And so Negro criminality becomes this example of what a criminal is outside of a norm, a standard white.
Right. And I wonder if maybe that feeds into some ideas of, the myth of the white man's burden, this idea, this feeding into this mythology of black criminality as part of a larger black pathology, which reinforces a white supremacy by arguing that there is some sort of cultural pathology associated with blackness, which reinforces the idea of whiteness and white supremacy needing to place itself morally advantaged over blackness, such that it sort of justifies and reinforces the white supremacist positions. So, back in slavery times, the plantation owners would argue that there was a sort of a cultural pathology or ineptitude inherent to blackness, which would rationalize slavery to some degree. They were, sort of saving the souls of black folks through bondage, which is horrible. But one wonders if maybe this is the new perspective of how white supremacy rationalizes itself by reinforcing a myth of black pathology and black criminality in order to reinforce the second-class position of black folks in America.
Well, just before we jump on that point, I want to make sure I got his title right. He's director of the Schoenberg Center for Research in Black Culture in Harlem. His name is Khalil Gibran Muhammad, and the book is The Condemnation of Blackness, Race, Crime, and the Making of Modern Urban America. Now, on to your point. I think you've hit on a really useful way of looking at many of these responses. In particular, this idea that we should be surprised. Oh my gosh, the police actually act this way.
Mm-hmm.
There's no surprise left in Black
America. I'm really surprised that. So I read a number of articles. I've been following the Ferguson timeline live tweet. The Ferguson Twitter timelines in order to get my news. And you've seen recently a lot of people going into that Twitter timeline trying to argue against the racialization of this issue as if there's no way to look at this as racial. And that really surprises me because I can't imagine a way to look at this shooting as anything but racially tinged. And I think the way to ask yourself that is to ask yourself whether or not Mike Brown would have been shot had he not had black skin. And in my mind, I don't think he would have been shot, because I think that the way that the myth of black criminality bears out in the real world is that you can have a black teenager who is 6'4", 200 and whatever number of pounds that he was, but he was perceived as a threat by the police officer. And one has to ask themselves whether or not the perceived threat is implicit to him because of the color of his skin. And I think the answer to that is yes, because we see so many statistics of black men who are being killed when they are unarmed facing off against police officers, where we don't see those kinds of statistics with virtually any other racial group. And really quickly, before you jump in, I did want to say to Iwan Dinar, if you're still watching this, you did successfully use the question and answer app, and if you continue to submit questions, we will be able to answer them on air, so you did it right, but the question you submitted was not one that we can answer, because it was just a hello world. Anyways, go ahead.
Yeah, I just want to say, just directly to that point, what I think is happening, and what I think matters when it comes to conversations about race in this, on this level, when it comes to race in the criminal justice system, is that I think it's important to understand that various types of Americans have different levels of trust with American systems of authority. Is there a way of looking at this that isn't racial? Yes, there definitely is. I'm not certain that there's a way of looking at what happened to Mike Brown, the tragic, you know, shooting of Mike Brown, that doesn't take into account the tragedy. And by that I mean the problem I have with the quote-unquote non-racial or non-interested in race interpretations of his death is that I don't believe those people see his death as an actual tragedy. I don't think they see a loss there, where in communities of color, the death of people of color is considered an actual loss. I used to work in Guilford, Connecticut. Guilford, Connecticut is a picturesque environment. It's on the shoreline here in Connecticut. Lots of wealthier or at least upper income people live there. It's got this wonderful manicured green where it's the center of town. It's kind of a small town intentionally. It's basically Pleasantville. I mean, if there's any sort of pop culture reference that would help viewers establish their mental sense of the space. And working there was always very interesting because people were always very pleasant and always very nice and always very white. And whiteness is not an indictment. There's no genetic propensity for group violence in the human genome. There's nothing wrong with being white. But in too many spaces in this society, in too many spaces in America, there is a presumption of wrong with being black. Being black and male is automatically something that will put various members of our society off. And these people will cite chapter and verse about crime statistics and where crimes happen and who's committing violent crimes, war on drugs, etc., and use that to justify preconceived notions about black criminality. Again, reading Khalil Gibran Muhammad's Condemnation of Blackness is absolutely integral for this. But in the real world...
I really, really quickly wanted to jump in connection to that point, because you've been arguing black males. Ike at Rebel Werewolf on Twitter is saying that he's read that police violence also affects black women, certainly to a larger extent than non-black people. So just another way to think about this is that this is something that affects black males predominantly. This is also something that affects the entire African-American community, I think, to a larger extent. This implied criminality relative to other non-black people of color communities.
I want to give a complete shout-out to Rebel Werewolf. He's got a very useful point there, and he's making a good point. However, I disagree with that point wholeheartedly.
He cites an article, which obviously we don't have time to read.
I'm not saying there isn't a substantive way of looking at things that says, yes, this happens to black women too. Of course that's true to a large degree. But I'm sorry. I don't think that the same types of... I think if you believe in that patriarchy exists, and if you believe that sexism exists, and you believe that you find patriarchy and sexism in systems of uniformed authority in the society, where if we're looking at the military, if we're looking at law enforcement, especially law enforcement, it's going to be hard to argue that there isn't an added difficulty presented to those officers, that thin blue line that's mostly male, that's mostly white in a lot of communities, especially in Ferguson, that's exactly what's happening, and that isn't also threatened by black masculinity in particular.
Right, and I think that the point that you're trying to get at here is when it comes to the conflation of blackness with masculinity with perceived threat, that the masculinity adds an extra layer of physical threat to the police officer's perception of the situation, such that they are more likely to become violent and to potentially react with lethal force. And to me, I think that that's in the Mike Brown shooting, because if you look at Officer Wilson's alternative explanation of what happened and everybody who's supporting him, the myth that they're putting out there, or at least the version that they're putting out there, involves a black man who first assaults the officer, goes for his gun, runs away, runs 35 feet, turns around, taunts him, so then you invoke sort of this thuggish gangster kind of stereotype. And then I think what's most galling is then he turns around and charges, quote unquote, like a bull at Officer Wilson and has to be put down as if he were, quote unquote, on drugs. And I think that that's what they're trying to do, is justify the shooting as a physical threat to Officer Wilson's life, even though the teenager was unarmed and even though he, you know, all of the independent eyewitnesses do not corroborate that story, except for today. Some are arguing that there are, but the ones that we had earlier in this week, all of the independent eyewitnesses did not corroborate that version. And I think that when we're talking about lethal police force and excessive force, which results in the death of an unarmed victim, the blackness is an intersection with masculinity that's creating a higher degree of perceived physical threat. And I think the physicality is important there. Would you agree with that?
I certainly think that's definitely part of it. And I guess I don't want to overemphasize this part of it as well. I mean, yes, there is a masculinity does matter here. And I don't think it's fair to the deaths that we've seen and we've seen reported to not remember that there's a long trend of being male and black that's important here. But that being said, it's not as if examples of black femininity haven't had some pretty harsh interactions.
Absolutely,
well.
Absolutely. I think that Ike is right here, and I have to go read the article, but I think Ike is right in pointing out that if you were to look at absolute rates, black women are probably perceived as more criminal and are victims of police violence to a far greater extent than non-black people of color. Probably across the genders is what I would guess. But I think the point that you're trying to get at is relative to masculinity, right?
Well, the point I'm trying to get at is you might find a situation where a black woman is detained. You will even find black grandmothers, like, beaten up. No-knock warrants where people will walk in, where the police will just bust into someone's house trying to prosecute a drug warrant and then shoot up everyone, including the grandmothers right there. These kinds of things happen. But my point is, what we saw in the Mike Brown situation is similar to what we've seen in various other situations, Eric Garner being an example, Oscar Grant being an example, where you have police officers involved in their own duty, trying to uphold the law, perceiving or at least allegedly in this situation, perceiving a black male as a threat warranting lethal force, which is a little different than an ass whipping. Now, whether or not like every single case, you know, gives a stark line here, I don't think is really relevant. One of the things that I think is really important here is when we discuss the idea of black male criminality, myth or not, quote unquote, we need to remember that we've been having this discussion for decades, centuries in a way.
Centuries.
And there's a futility that has come into play. I think what you've seen from President Obama's two statements on the subject thus far, what you've seen is a clinical detachment that speaks directly to the need to not only balance the perceptions from the black community and from other communities of color about inappropriate police work, resulting in actual death and actual tragedy and actual loss, but balancing that with the perceptions of essentially all these other communities in America who see the death of black males as normal.
Mm-hmm.
Not just like it a tragedy or just sad or no, none of that. Normal. And that makes a very different kind of conversation to have. The president's been in a really negative situation. I think a lot of people have roundly dismissed and disagree with his interpretation of events. But what I think we're seeing is really Ferguson, Missouri is the photo negative of everything you heard about race from Obama for America in 2007 and 2008. This whole entire perception that electing Barack Hussein Obama Jr. To the presidency was going to end racism as we knew it in America was always false. No people of color ever believed it. And even when he gave these landmark speeches on race that essentially equivocated the perceptions of white people who are afraid of black masculinity to the point of using lethal force against it with essentially black grievance about unjust labor policies and redlining and all manner of like de facto and de jure segregation, equating those two was always illogical. Equating those two was always about justifying what a mainstream or a white mainstream could feel about race openly. And Ferguson is the result. If we are able to look at America today as being somehow post-racial, we don't go into situations where there's practically anemic political representation for African Americans in a community where they are a majority, and actually say, okay, we have a police department that's going above and beyond what standards of policing are today against black bodies. They have no representation to change that, and we're all okay with it because race doesn't matter? Like, this is the problem with Obama's America on race. This is why it's something that we should all think about. And this is also why if we're willing to look at black male death as normal, we're never going to solve any of these problems.
Well, we not only think of it as normal, but what I think was most shocking for me, or not shocking, but at least distressing for me, was to watch the aftermath of the shooting and to watch people from, you know, the Ferguson police chief all the way up, I would argue, to the president, whom I'm a huge supporter of otherwise, but I think he really dropped the ball this past week, which was in essence to blame the victim, to find ways to justify the shooting death of an unarmed teenager as if there is any combination of circumstances under which you could say that this was a clean shoot for a police officer. I think that when you have the immediate knee-jerk reaction to talk about Mike Brown's supposed criminality, where you release the robbery video as if to imply that he was a criminal, ergo he deserved to be shot, or to point out his size as if he was just de facto a physical threat, and ergo he deserved to be shot. I saw one autopsy report that I think that was released by the Ferguson, or at least details leaked from the Ferguson police department, where they suggested that he had traces of marijuana in his system, ergo he deserved to be shot. And then you have this ridiculous story from Officer Wilson, or that we hear secondhand through an alleged family friend, who's arguing this ridiculous timeline of events where he runs out and he taunts the officer after trying to go for his gun, and then he charges him like a bull. And I think I was saying to you earlier that that version of events goes completely against the talk. Everything you learn from the talk says this is not something you would ever do. And yet you see this being hammered time and time again, linked to statistics about how many arrests are made to reinforce this myth that black men are innately criminal and therefore they deserve this excessive police violence, as if black lives don't matter. And that is frustrating to me.
I can understand that. I can definitely understand how it would be a frustration, but this is America. Black lives don't matter.
Well,
no, that's the response. I mean, that is the lived experience of, I would say, most black people in the society. But I don't think that happens to all black people. And one of the reasons why, going back to Michelle Alexander, one of the reasons why the political thrust of her book is something that I very much disagree with is that there's an assumption that if we look at mass incarceration today, we should consider it in the same light as Jim Crow segregation and chattel slavery, i.e. a racial caste system that does not allow people, African Americans today, to escape its clutches. That by and large, most to the point of all black people are subject to this, or by and large, most if not all black men are subject to this. And on that, I very much disagree. What I think happens to guys like Mike Brown is something that theoretically can happen to all black men, and that theoretically all black men have to guard against. But it doesn't happen to all black men. It would be, I think we would be remiss if we didn't talk about some of the ways that class interacts with this, some of the ways that geography interacts with this, some of the ways that having employment, even white-collar employment, it doesn't insulate anyone from a stop and frisk policy or unjust policing, but there is a difference in how you are perceived. You can't put on a suit and somehow alter the perception that you might engender in the mind of a police officer that you're less of a criminal threat. But the guys who are wearing suits in lots of places in America don't have guns shoved in their face every day. Every week, but not necessarily every day.
But I would
it becomes a bit difficult. I'm sorry, just to finish this point, it becomes very difficult for many of us to have this conversation rationally. I'm thinking of Eugene Robinson and Walter Williams, who have both in recent days brought up the idea of black-on-black crime as the real scourge assaulting the black community and assaulting the black body that we should think about. Ta-Nehisi Coates, writing in The Atlantic, has written a scathing dismissal of this idea. But what I think is actually important with that conversation is we know already, the statistics aren't going to lie to us here either, we know there's a high degree of violent crime in African-American communities. It's like a high degree of violent crime throughout the country. We don't think that relatively there's a higher degree so much of violent crime in the black community necessarily than like in other communities, but certainly the way we're looking at the statistics, the way we do this policing, there's more police scrutiny in African-American communities than there would be and is, I would say, in a lot of other communities. So take, for example, the differences between Guilford, Connecticut, which I already mentioned, and New Haven, Connecticut, where I work today. We have much more, by virtue of local stories on this, about criminality in New Haven than we do in Guilford. And so people living in Guilford or living along the shoreline often think of their communities as being relatively crime-free. Whether or not that's actually true given the numbers isn't necessarily relevant because there's a larger population in New Haven, there's a larger police presence in New Haven, and there's more urban. I'm sorry?
It's more urban. People are much more closely populated next to each
also
other.
Also true, and there's much more of an interest in prosecuting the war on drugs in New Haven because of its larger African-American population than there is along the shoreline where people still get high on the regular. So we don't necessarily know if the crime rates are all that distinct and all that excessive in the New Haven model than if they are in the shoreline model or in Guilford. But we do know black people live over here, and so the people living on the shoreline, who are mostly white and wealthy, would much rather see that police scrutiny applied judiciously to the blacks over there, outside of their lived experience. That alone presents many of the problems we have talking about this, and a focus on black-on-black crime, while important, doesn't get at the heart of that matter at all. And it certainly doesn't get us close to having a conversation about the excessive militarization of municipal police departments that you see on display, not just in Ferguson, Missouri, but also in Boston, right after the marathon bombings.
I really, really quickly wanted to just comment that my issue with the black-on-black crime argument is that I think it, again, gives a little bit of shade to the argument that somehow these deaths by excessive police force are somehow justified, or that, you know, we're justified in not caring about black lives and when they're lost. I feel like, again, like you're pointing out, which I really don't have a lot of commentary other than I generally agree, this is such a complex issue. It's an intersection of class and race, and I think that in national conversations like this, across the board, we have a tendency to oversimplify it and forget how the intersection of class is nuancing this argument. But I think that unless you have something you want to add to that, pivoting over to the police militancy issue I think is really interesting, and I'd like to spend a couple minutes talking about that before we sort of look at the bigger picture about where to go from here. Yeah, you're good. Okay, so I think one of the things that was really interesting to me with the Mike Brown shooting in Ferguson was how I feel like this whole situation, I think there was a massive outcry, as well there should be, regarding Mike Brown's death. But then as the sort of the week progressed, we saw, I think, the lengths that white supremacy will go towards defending its own system. And that became so galling that that almost became the story. It became the story about how the police are, again, reinforcing this myth of black criminality through their excessive militarization of their law enforcement practices in Ferguson, how they assumed that a congregation of black protesters who are peacefully demonstrating would immediately turn violent. And in fact, none of those protests turned violent until the police sort of cracked down in this sort of Gestapo style, enacting curfews, pointing guns, waving their guns around at people, and just sort of basically taking over and occupying Ferguson, Missouri, by force, by gunpoint. So I wonder if you, as a poli-sci major, in particular, I'm interested in hearing your point of view, James, about whether or not this is legal for the as far as the police are concerned, and sort of why this, I think, became an issue that also grabbed national attention, that sort of is about race and is about the myth of black criminality, again reinforced with why the police were rationalizing their own actions, but also that sort of became a constitutional conversation in regards to the rights of police officers and the rights of citizens.
Well, let me first start by saying I'm not a lawyer.
I didn't say you were a lawyer. I said you were a poli-sci major.
I recognize that, but it's important to make sure it's clear that these are just my opinions alone and have almost zero basis in an understanding of the statutes on the subject. That being said, what we saw last week and leading into this week was the takeover of a small town by its municipal police force. We saw citizens barred from their free and constitutionally protected right of assembly and protest by virtue of the municipal police force that they fund through their own tax dollars. That is about as, if that doesn't frighten you, like, I don't know what will. I mean, having nothing to do whatsoever with race, this should be the intersection point between all manner of people on the right who are afraid of government encroachment and all the people on the left who are afraid of not being able to protest anything. Like, if this isn't the intersection between the Tea Party and Occupy Wall Street, I don't know what else could be. Like, this is all about literally a local government steps in and says, no, you cannot. And we know you can't because we've got tanks and we've got tear gas and we've got rubber bullets and we've got the manpower to keep you in place. A manpower that we're willing to deploy in this situation against the citizenry itself. I want to bring up Boston after the marathon bombings again because I think it gives us a useful counterpoint. In that situation, because of the threat of terrorism, we saw a similar takeover of a city for an extended period of time while the police were able to track down the remaining bomber. Now, there are many people who had a problem with that then and should have had a problem with it. It's incorrigible. My right as a citizen to freely move around public spaces should not really be impeded for pretty much almost any reason. And no, I don't think that prosecuting like one lone terrorist necessarily means that the city should be shut down for 2 days. But this situation is almost more galling to me because here you have citizens organized, if loosely, but still organized to protest police action, and they're being denied that ability by the police force. I mean, many, many, many commentators have spoken to this. Connor Friesdorf in The Atlantic is a voice that I've been reading recently on this subject. And yeah, as a libertarian, I can see his point. I mean, he's a libertarian, not me. But I can definitely understand the point. We should be very frightened by that. Because the entire reason that the NRA exists, on paper anyway, is to give regular citizens the right to defend themselves and their homes by other kinds of encroachment. And that's been taken to mean individual criminal encroachment and also the encroachment from government.
Yes.
So given that logic, there's nothing wrong with, say, arming the peaceful protesters of Ferguson, Missouri, and let them shoot back at cops who aren't allowing them to freely protest. But as was pointed out on NPR today, you do that, and it's not going to go down the same way as, say, Clyde and Bundy and the people on his ranch. No, because these are black people, and they're going to get shot and killed. Remember, they're shooting unarmed black men.
Yeah. So, right. And you bring up the really great point because, as you were saying earlier today to me, the Clive and Bundy story, you had people protesting the government and actually using guns in order to protect what they perceived to be their right. Now, we can obviously argue whether or not he actually had any rights that he needed to be protecting to that land. But that being said, Clive and Bundy was not shot and killed by federal authorities for his political actions.
No, it's worse than that. When the gunfight happened, the feds pulled back so as to prevent any loss of life. Mm-hmm. Federal government. This wasn't local government, but I mean, federal officials go to have a conversation with Mr. Bundy about his free grazing, like it's something out of an old Robert Duvall, Kevin Costner movie, and And next thing you know, there's a gunfight with the federal government. It's a bizarre idea here. And the reason I think this is important is that if you follow this logic, widely held and protected to the point of killing any type of gun control legislation, this is what the NRA is designed to do, and they're very, very good at it as an interest group. Kill any kind of sensible gun control legislation after Newtown, Connecticut, after all manner of shooting and deaths of black people, black men especially. You have that logic saying, my right to a gun to defend my home and to defend, you know, my honor as a citizen is, you know, without peer. And yet, we're watching and allowing a police department to use military force against citizens, literally engage in acts of, not even of civil disobedience, but just chanting and walking around. Mm-hmm. This is the point where if you're not afraid, you should be.
Yeah. I really quickly wanted to read another tweet from Ike, who's tweeting from @RebelWerewolf, who writes, the perception of police militarization was different in Boston. Majority of people were cheering on the police, and there were no protesters. And I think that he sort of, and I'm glad that you kind of have answered that point a little bit, but one thing I thought that was really interesting was that I think that for the most part, people were supportive of the militarization. I agree that they probably shouldn't have been, but I do think that the parallel there falls apart because the parallel that we're making between Boston and Ferguson, in the sense that in Boston, there was someone who had allegedly committed a federal violent crime, which was domestic terrorism, who was on the run, and it was not clear whether or not he was armed, ready to do this again. And so there was, at least in terms of the public perception, a sense of wanting to protect oneself from someone who had already committed a crime. When you compare that to Ferguson, protesters haven't committed a crime. In fact, they're exercising their First Amendment rights. And so it's hard to argue that the police militarization makes sense there and that it could in any way be justified. Ike goes ahead and tweets, the Boston bomber was caught in a suburb that was 90% white, and the perception was police that they were perception of the police was that they were protecting Bostonians from terrorism. And that actually pivots me perfectly to the point that I wanted to make regarding Ferguson, which was one thing that stuck out in my mind last week, was when you started seeing the police militarization happening, and I think it was day 3 or so of the protests, the police chief of Ferguson was arguing that he wanted to bring in SWAT and the riot police because he wanted to protect the middle-class families that were just outside of the area of protest, that he started talking about the safety of the residents of Ferguson who were not the protesters. And that, to me, reminded me of Boston. It reminded me also of the LA riots, where the police suddenly feel like this need to intervene and intervene strongly when it becomes a perceived threat on whiteness. And that, I think, is particularly damning. That, to me, that is exactly what happened in Ferguson. They militarized because all of a sudden the white residents of Ferguson started freaking out that they might become the targets of possible violence, even though these were all peaceful protests. But it was just the threat of congregating black skin, basically, that was creating this myth of physical threat and violence.
And that's why I've said for years, the police do not exist to protect and serve me. Police exists to protect you from me. Like, just as a black person, I don't understand how it's logical to look at police as your friends. And I don't think that the color of the police matters. I think the system trains people to see to give in to the public perception and the stereotype of black criminality as automatically something to protect good people from. I mean, just the quote that you mentioned from the Ferguson police chief says it all. There are good citizens who aren't protesting that we need to protect their lives and their property from the bad citizens who are protesting. I mean, that's the dichotomy, you know, raised. And I don't see how it's possible to respect that. But also what's interesting here is that once you start going up a level or two, no one's suggesting that guy is right. I mean, one of the more interesting elements of the kind of media scrutiny applied to Ferguson today is that if you're looking at the city fathers of Ferguson, Missouri, you know, the mayor and city council and the police chief and the upper levels of that police department, they're not getting cover here. They're not getting political support.
Now. I mean, if you're talking about, you know, 3 days after the shooting, I think that they were, because they were allowed to maintain the investigation and the security for so long, I think they did have political cover for 3 or 4 days before they fucked it up royally and the feds jumped in.
Well, I'm certainly suggesting that they didn't get any of that from a federal government. I mean, the scrutiny that we're seeing from the Justice Department in general, and especially today with Eric Holder's visit, suggests that there is simply no respect whatsoever for the established criminal justice system in Ferguson to get any of this right. The idea that a sitting attorney general will travel to literally the most controversial legal area in the country right now just to sort of calm fears and have conversations about what the Justice Department can do to prosecute the very people who they believe have caused all this mess, who aren't the regular citizens, who aren't necessarily even Mike Brown, but really the Ferguson Police Department, is a galling change from what we've seen before. And it should suggest to us that even when the public statements from the man on top aren't exactly what we would want to hear, that his administration is very much committed to useful and aggressive prosecution of civil rights statutes. I mean, the Obama administration hasn't gotten everything right, but certainly the Holder Justice Department has been as live as they want to be about trying to prosecute successfully criminal civil rights violations. And I certainly think that's also what the investigations that we're starting to see here are leading very much towards that.
Mm-hmm. Well, I just wanted to, we have maybe about 15 minutes to go, and I did really want to talk about a few other things before we wind down. And one of the things that I think that we can talk about is the response from the police chief as well as from people online. You know, there was a poll out, I think yesterday or so, that polled black respondents versus white respondents, and they were asked basically whether or not Ferguson was racialized, whether or not they thought excessive force happened, whether or not the shooting was clean. And something like 78 or 76% of black respondents agreed that this was excessive police force and that police militarization was a problem, compared to only 33% of white respondents felt that way, which I think is a very stark racial disparity in responding to those questions. And one of the things that I'm about to make a really ridiculous comparison, and so I apologize in advance that this is kind of silly, but one of the things that sort of has been on my mind was how folks in the mainstream, white folks, how they respond to racialized issues and how they seem to respond with an excessive irrational defensiveness. And the reason I'm sort of thinking about this is because, you know, when you look at the Mike Brown shooting and how people are sort of bending over backwards to try and excuse the shooting. And then I was sort of, another thing that I've been blogging about on the blog this past week was the yellow face incident in Seattle regarding Gilbert and Sullivan show of the Mikado. And the only comparison I'm going to make there, because I realize otherwise this is a ridiculous analogy, but the only comparison I want to make is the absurdity of the kinds of responses you saw in defending the racism. And it sort of struck me as sort of this, like, kind of a similar kind of white rage that was going on, this sort of, like, anger that this could be seen as racial, this anger that you might be perceived as participating or perpetuating white supremacy. And in both cases, it sort of comes across as ridiculous, the things that people will say in order to try and excuse even considering it from a racial lens. And that sort of leads me towards asking the question whether or not there really are ways to have solidarity between the black community on Ferguson and non-black communities of color. And so I posed this question to Twitter, and I got a bunch of tweets that I actually want to read to you before we sort of tackle this question. The Laos Assistance Center, which is a really wonderful institution, by the way, a really wonderful group that I've worked with a little bit in terms of blogging, they write, systems that make disparities for one community are often enabled to do to others. And so to live up to our ideals, we must speak up against them. Drawing upon these similar ideas of institutions of racism that affect all communities of color. Prefab politician who tweets at OrdC writes, solidarity with Ferguson matters because if we are complicit in white supremacy, there will be nobody for us when they come for us. And finally, at Thalwara, and I apologize if I butchered that pronunciation, writes, Laotians are currently dealing with excessive police force and police militarization in Georgia. We understand the trauma community faces in such times. And that's just a representative sampling of some of the wonderful tweets that I was getting just before the show started. And so I was wondering whether or not you think that this is a meaningful project to try and find solidarity between what's going on in Ferguson with other communities of color and the issues that we go through, but also to walk that fine balance between finding ways to be in solidarity without trying to usurp or erase the unique racisms that different communities face, which I think is also the danger there. I don't think that as an Asian American or Chinese American myself, I can really say, you know, I experience police brutality in the same way that you do, James. Like, I don't think that that's something that we should even try as a project. So how do we find that solidarity?
Two things. One, I think that the problem here has a lot to do with the term solidarity itself and the political weight and history behind that term. In particular, we like to use the word solidarity, in, especially in leftist circles, left-wing circles, liberal circles, progressive circles, because it harkens back to the glory days of the 60s and 70s, where you could have a white student left and working with a black student left. You could have, like, SDS and later the Black Panthers, or SDS and later, like, Freedom Summer, like, supporters, and you could have a general fight against many of these systems of oppression that do have like a disparate impact on different communities, and still feel like there was a unified front against it. I am not a member of the crowd who believes that project is possible today. I don't think solidarity as a term helps. I don't think solidarity is what we should go for. What I think we should go for are just a clear-eyed and reasoned observation of the ways in which various systems of oppression affect us all individually. Because then I think we can have a conversation that doesn't involve the kind of glossing over the details that the Solidarity Project, I think, allows.
Sorry, I just really quickly want to clarify. Are you suggesting that perhaps the term solidarity has become a bit of a buzzword term that almost erases the details?
Almost certainly. I mean, one of the things that you kept hearing in sort of in Twitter activism, like, literally all year long, earlier this year when it was Twitter activism against Dan Snyder and the Redskins, solidarity with Native peoples, right? And that solidarity with Native peoples turned into a co-optation when Sui Park took on a lot of that issue when she watched the Colbert Report like a day after or so and noticed a satirical take on what Dan Snyder was doing and took that satirical take to be an attack on her people. Whether or not she was right or wrong is not for me to litigate, but what is definitely true is that the story out of that joke became whether or not it was acceptable or permissible to have a conversation about the Redskins that made use of Ching Chong language and Asian American stereotypes. Now, how if a person agrees with that or not is, again, not up for me. But what's very clear is that the point behind Dan Snyder, the Redskins' name, what can and cannot be used as a public sports team, none of that was the issue. And it continued to not be the issue. Solidarity is just, it's really the wrong way of looking at it. I don't necessarily need to have solidarity with feminists to know that sexism is a bad thing, you know?
And I understand your point. I think that we kind of disagree a little bit because I actually, so personally, I buy into the quote-unquote solidarity project. But I feel like you're right that too often what we call solidarity is erasing the details. And I think that what we should really be striving for is meaningful solidarity. Solidarity is sort of the dictionary definition of the term, which is to say ways in which we can support other people's movements, other people's issues, while still allowing them to take the lead and still allowing their voices to be heard over us, so that we can become the kind of allies where we are supporting the movements without taking over the movements. And I think that, you know, you raised the interesting point about the Cancel Colbert versus the Not Your Mascot movement, and I think that was an example of not useful solidarity in the sense that it completely erased the voices of Native peoples. And I think that that is always a fine balancing act that we as people of color should be trying to do when we do, when we engage in this idea of solidarity, is to not do it in a buzzword kind of way, not to just, you know, hashtag everything that we write that's not about who we are, hashtag solidarity, but actually to try and find ways to build bridges across racial barriers and to actually understand other people's identities. So create meaningful solidarity using the dictionary definition of the word.
I'm sorry, I disagree. You attended very recently and wrote about on the blog a solidarity protest towards, you know, the protesters in Ferguson happening on the Yale campus. And I walked down there with you, you know, for that and didn't stay for it. And one of the reasons I didn't stay was that I was expecting to see, okay, here's the center of New Haven, a protest in solidarity with the protesters in Ferguson. I expected to see black people. There are a lot of black people in New Haven. And instead, I saw a summer Yale community. Lots of white people, lots of young kids, essentially, you know, college students, you know, 20-something's young for me, I'm sorry, I got gray hair.
You can't tell in the podcast at all. If you hadn't said anything.
I'm calling it out. the point here is, I saw very few people who looked like me. And the people who I did see, I'm sorry, those are not the people who are going to have Glocks shoved in their face or thrown up against the sides of buildings to get frisked roughly in drug searches randomly. It's just not going to happen. No matter how much drug use or possible drug use those communities are going to have, no one's going to take a 5'1" Asian woman and slam her up against a brick wall looking for marijuana. It's just not happening. And the fact that it's not happening says to me, yes, she can be concerned about when that does happen to other American citizens. She can protest that happens to other American citizens. But I'm not so sure what she's going to say about when that happens. And I think that the Solidarity Project is a useful one, but we need to bring up a civic solidarity, not necessarily a racial solidarity. There are definite jumping on points for people who are not black to talk about the issues involving Ferguson, whether it's unjust police work that can affect everyone, selective police work, where we go after like low-level or attempt to go after low-level drug dealers with a vitriol and a violence that will never apply towards white-collar criminals who rob the system of trillions of dollars. Like, we can actually have those kinds of conversations without having to necessarily bring up a racial solidarity. But the Racial Solidarity Project, I don't think it works intra-racially. I'll say it. I think black women have a lot of reason to be very afraid about the activities that have happened to Mike Brown and Eric Garner and Jordan Davis and Oscar Grant and a whole host of other individuals. But we should remember that these are black men we're talking about and not black women. And it matters to me that masculinity is part of the conversation here. I don't think my nieces and my sisters are under the same kind of gun that I am. Period. And if that's like too controversial a point or something that we can't bring up because our need to bring up solidarity, that we're all in this together, that kind of idea might alienate people, I'm sorry. If that's going to alienate people, maybe they should be alienated because everyone's not under the same gun.
Well, so I think that that's a really interesting point that you're making, but I think what was actually most interesting was this definition of solidarity being all of us in it together. And for me, that's not necessarily the way that I look at solidarity, in the sense that I think that, you know, the tweets that I read bring up the things that we are all in it together under. Like, we're all in it together when it comes to white supremacy. But how white supremacy affects us as Chinese Americans versus Laotians versus African Americans versus Latinos and versus Native people is going to be different. And I think that when we're trying to do solidarity, we need to find ways to find links, maybe, like political links, but not ways that appropriate other people's narratives. And I think that too often we do see that happening.
Before we wind down, I know we're short on time, but let's also have a bit of a conversation about the ways in which this solidarity gets expressed. I mean, I'm seeing a lot of stuff in public online spaces that is attempting a type of solidarity with the events happening in Ferguson. And while much of that is like in the right emotional place, I'm not so sure it's in the right political one or in a one or in a practical sense useful. I just find symbolism to be a very poor substitute here. You know, taking pictures with your hands raised, saying with a caption that says "Don't shoot," doesn't do very much in the grand scheme to talk about the ways in which we have codified violence against Black American males in our society in pursuit of a just and quiet society. We don't talk about wearing a hoodie is not going to help Trayvon Martin's family. Raising your hands doesn't bring Mike Brown back. And it doesn't, most importantly, speak to the real issues that we could have in a civic discussion about actual statutes and laws. Mm-hmm. Connor Friesdorf, for example, brought up the idea that maybe the night protests in Ferguson should end instead of doing night protests, going around to collect signatures to engage a recall election of the mayor and city council of Ferguson to replace them with a pro-protester slate that would fire the upper levels of the police department and force the change of the Ferguson Police Department that we haven't seen yet. And it spoke directly not only to the idea of getting rid of political leaders that aren't serving your interests, Black people take note, but also the idea that we haven't seen very much on the level of actual political activism from much of the Ferguson story. A lot of it has been in the streets protesting as if just by virtue of walking around every night chanting "No justice, no peace," at some point change is just going to come. And it's that kind of pie-in-the-sky, wishful thinking, almost faith in the evidence of things not seen that works directly against the kind of civic knowledge and civic solidarity that I think it would be much more useful here. If people of color, generally, and interested parties want to go into Ferguson and start generating a political groundswell of support to knock out the entrenched powers that have allowed this police department to go so off the rails, on that I would applaud every day. But I don't think we're seeing that through hashtags, and I don't think we're seeing that through pictures and selfies with your hands raised. And until it gets to that meaningful political activism point, the symbolism and the solidarity, in my opinion, is meaningless.
Well, I think this gets to a little bit the decentralization of Twitter hashtag activism and how I think that as a movement and how we've moved digitally, we haven't quite overcome these structural obstacles in the tools that we're using and how we can integrate them into our activism so that we're not spinning our wheels. But if you're interested in that, viewers, that is actually the topic of an episode that we're recording 2 weeks or 4 weeks from now, 3 weeks from now, September 8th, sorry. I've invited representatives from 18 Million Rising, and we will be tackling this exact question. So in terms of me, I didn't really get to express what I think in terms of solidarity. The one thing that I think is that I think it's important to find the links. But to me, I mean, I sort of started blogging about the Ferguson issue, not necessarily because I found a specific link to my own identity as an Asian American. And one thing that I really like that you're talking about, James, in a couple of things that I disagree with, but one thing that I like is this idea of civic solidarity and civic engagement. For me, what really strikes home is a sort of general, this is what America is, this is what America should be kind of question. It's more of a civic question than identifying things that I or the Asian American community deal with that are exactly the same. Rather, it's I think that this is a chance to focus the topics on Blackness and on anti-Blackness and white supremacy as it affects that, rather than to sort of try to force the Asian American identity or the identity of other communities of color into the conversation. I think sometimes it makes sense. I think that the tweets that I read about structural racism actually are very poignant and relevant. But I've seen sort of a mishmash of conversation on this topic, at least from the Asian American community, and I think that, so Ike at Rebel Werewolf asked me again whether or not I might comment on the response from the Asian American community on Ferguson, and I don't know what's going on with the entire community, but there's some things that have been done that I think are good, and some things that I've read that are maybe you know, less topical or less relevant. I think that in general our community was a little too slow to respond to this particular topic, and I think that maybe, you know, if there's a next time, God forbid there's a next time, but, you know, we all know that there's going to be a next time, that we are on the ball a little bit more in order to try and build a sort of a conversation about this within the Asian American community that isn't starting 7 days after this all happened. But more specifically, I think I've read articles that have tried to argue how this is exactly like the Asian American identity, and I don't necessarily think that's important. I've read also articles that have talked about centering conversations about blackness, and I think I wrote an article that came at it from that perspective that had very little to do with the Asian American identity, and where it did bring it up was more underscoring the things that I don't know because I'm not black. And I think that that's sort of a different way to address solidarity than maybe this buzzwordy way that we're doing solidarity. And to focus instead on a civic solidarity where we're all angered because this is sort of the communal project of America that we're all invested in, and so we're invested in bettering it for that reason. I sort of wanted to wind us down a little bit by asking whether or not this time you think will be different. You know, we started off this podcast by listing several black men who have been killed within the last decade or so, maybe, of who've been killed in police violence, all of them unarmed, all of them shot to death. Do you think this time will be different? Yes, no, maybe?
No, not at all. Never. No. But again, I'm biased in the sense that my personal safety depends upon not seeing the difference. Like, I can't allow myself to think that I'm going to live in an America that will somehow be nicer to my skin and my gender. That's not a possibility. I would thereby, by thinking that way, I would put my life in the hands of people who don't have a track record of respecting my body or bodies like mine. Like, it's just, that's what you're doing. When you walk outside of your house, or sometimes just in your house, Fred Hampton, you, living as a black man today, you are basically hoping against hope that you'll make it to your destination and back safely and unmolested. And the truth is, you have reason to fear criminals like everyone else, but you also have reason to fear police, not like everyone else. There was a piece in the Washington Post recently, a LAPD officer and professor who believes very strongly that police officers should wear cameras, so there should be cameras in the vehicles, so we all have a record of what's going on in these police interactions. But the major thrust of his argument was that if you don't want to be molested, assaulted, like harmed by police, give them absolutely no trouble, speak respectfully, and just generally do what they say, or they're going to just thrash you. Now, on one level, he's absolutely right. That is what the response is going to be. Give police officers any level of negativity, and you're asking for them to hurt you is the street level truth that we should deal with. But it's certainly what the talk is all about. You don't do that. You don't respond negatively to police because police will kill you. That's what I was told at home. The police will shoot you and kill you, James. So this is what you have to do in every circumstance. There is no way to mistake this. One split second and you're done. I was told that at 8, I was told that at 13, I was told that at 15, I was told that at 33 when I went home just this last weekend. It's that real. However, the plight of the police officer won't engender my sympathy, and I have to know that the plight of the black man will not engender the police officer's sympathy. It's just not possible. So I cannot see how anything is going to ever be changed. But again, I'm biased, because even if there was a meaningful change, this particular black man will never trust it. I can't afford to. I don't exist in a post-racial world. I have to assume in every instance that the police are there to hurt me.
I think that answering this question, I think this time will be different if we're able to overcome the obstacle of how to turn a groundswell of energy and passion into meaningful civic civic change. And I think that that is not a trivial thing to do. I think I had a chance to think about what Connor Friersdorf suggests, which is basically recall Ferguson. And I'm a little bit surprised. Maybe I'm just not aware of this, but I think that if there's going to be a hashtag, it should be hashtag recall Ferguson. I think the idea of collecting signatures and turning what is protest movements across the country into a grassroots movement to fund a political action committee, to recall the entire political board of Ferguson, and to elect new officials who are first representative of Ferguson, second, not willing to violate the civil rights of the residents of Ferguson, and then to have that political the new political representatives fire the entire leadership of the police department ultimately is a really interesting idea, but one that will require, I don't know that it's necessarily a practical one. I think that when you told me about this, and I'm sorry I haven't read the article, but when you told me about this, it felt a little bit like Monday morning quarterbacking. The assumption that somehow this is a centralized protest movement rather than something that's more organic. And so I don't know that if in the absence of some sort of civic-minded, coordinated political action, whether or not this time ultimately will be different, or if 6 months from now or a year from now, we will be marching for another unarmed black man who was killed by cops. You know, one thing that we talked about, James, was how we actually participated in the marches for Amadou Diallo, who was killed something like nearly a decade ago. And he was shot 41 times by NYPD for reaching for his wallet. And, you know, nearly a decade later, not much has changed. So I think that I understand your pessimism, that it doesn't seem like much is going to be changed and that this time may be different, may not be different, unless we can find some way to both understand what I think is a righteous expression of anger in Ferguson on the streets right now, but to turn that into some sort of formalized political action. And, you know, if anyone's watching this, I really think that we need to start organizing and find a way to raise money to recall Ferguson. I think it's a good idea, but we need to do it.
Just on that point, and really quickly, you mentioned the idea of the difference between centralized movements and decentralized movements. One thing that I think is really becoming starkly apparent by the Ferguson example is that the decentralized movements have a long way to go. This is not the civil rights movement. There's no hierarchy. And one of the things that we've seen in recent political activism, especially from younger people, millennials, etc., is that this online decentralized like hashtag version of it is somehow useful for political change because this is the tool that's presented. Again, you're going to talk about this in a later podcast, and I don't want to like, step on that too much, but if this is what decentralized protesting looked like, we don't want decentralized protesting. The truth about the Ferguson example is that the average black person on the ground before this incident had very, very little political power, little political clout, not a whole lot was happening there. And that is why there's no representative political apparatus from the community to fall back on in time of dire need like this one. So in essence, there is probably already, but you know, a movement towards creating that kind of apparatus. And the fact that it has not really existed in any sort of meaningful way before, to the point that people are in the streets and they're protesting because they're angry, but that's literally all we're hearing about, says a lot about where the limits of the decentralized protest. It's really about expressing an emotional response, but not necessarily a rational political one or a civic engagement that was actually going to make change. So okay. I want to see that civic engagement before I'm willing to suggest there's anything close to a reason to be optimistic here. And even then, like I said, I wouldn't trust it.
So on that note, which a very sad, pessimistic note, I'm going to make you happy then, to make you happy. I'm going to say that Ike says that you don't look 33, James, and your gray hairs are not visible on the podcast. So you should thank Ike for saying that to you.
Much love to Ike. Thank you. That does actually help.
There we go. I'm also going to say, I'm going to end on a slightly more positive note and say that if anyone is listening, I would really suggest that, rather than to simply hashtag, I think hashtagging and sort of these kind of protest movements do have value in raising awareness and raising consciousness. So that's something that we'll talk about in a later podcast. But that's sort of my bias. I actually do believe in the power of education and consciousness building. But if anyone's listening, I think that right now, 10 days later, we need to be organizing. And I would hope that if there were anybody from Ferguson who's plugged into the local political community, that they are building a Recall Ferguson PAC right now. And if and when that PAC shows up in your inbox or in your Twitter, that all the anger that you're feeling right now will translate into donations or raising awareness or some other civic engagement to try and recall the leadership of Ferguson and try to add political clout to Ferguson's black community, because you're right. I think that that's what's going to make this time different if we can do that. On that note, I did want to end the podcast unless there's anything else you want to add, James?
Nope, just I hope everyone in Ferguson continues to stay safe and hope that they don't get arrested, and I hope they're able to maintain some just basic decency out there, because really, these are people engaged in political action. They shouldn't be harmed by police because of it.
Mm-hmm. And since we've established that I disagree slightly with James on the concept of solidarity, I actually do stand in solidarity with the residents of Ferguson and hope that you all stay safe and understand that there are people on the other side of the country who definitely are standing with you as best we can in Connecticut. I want to thank all of the viewers who tuned in to this sort of last-minute state of emergency Reappropriate podcast recording. At one time, we had up to 8 viewers watching simultaneously, so I want to thank you all for tuning in, as well as the several people who tweeted before and during the show. And I really welcome your comments and questions, and really thank you for keeping this conversation engaged. If you're interested in the podcast, after the fact, you'll be able to stream a recording of this podcast through YouTube using both video and audio. You can also subscribe to Reappropriate the Podcast through the iTunes Store. And I really encourage you to check out the scheduled Reappropriate Podcast episode, which will now be episode number 5 of this podcast, which is going to be recording on August 27th at 7 p.m. Eastern Time. And for that episode, I will be tackling the question, what is Asian American Pacific Islander feminism? And to tackle that topic, I've invited guest Juliet Shen from the Fast Nations Tumblr, Fast Nations blog. I want to thank everybody again for listening, and James, thank you for being on the show.
Thank you for having me.
All right. Take care, everybody, and we'll see you next week.